Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Kyati Joshi on her new book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. A little bit about our guest. Kyati Joshi is a public intellectual whose social science research and community connections inform policymakers, educators, and everyday people about race, religion, and immigration in 21st century America. Her most recent book is the one I just mentioned, White Christian Privilege. She is also the author and co-editor of Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice, one of the most widely used books by diversity practitioners and scholars alike. Her other works include New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America, and Asian Americans in Dixie, Race and Migration in the South. She has lectured around the world, including at the White House. As a professor of education at Fairleigh Dickinson University, Dr. Joshi received the 2014 Distinguished Faculty Award for Research and Scholarship. Professor Joshi received her education at the University of Massachusetts, Emory University, and Hebrew University of Jerusalem. She has been quoted in numerous publications in the United States and abroad, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, The Times of India, and The Record. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Dr. Kyati Joshi. Hello, Kyati.
Hello, Fred. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. So where we left off last week, we were talking about various expressions of white and Christian privilege in the United States, and we were going back to the actual foundation of this country. And one of the things we talked about was your understanding that there really is a Christian foundation even with the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. I'd like you to talk about the First Amendment. And give me your honest opinion. Do you think that both of those go far enough? If the Founding Fathers were alive today, first of all, they probably wouldn't smell really good, regardless of that. If they asked your advice on religious freedom, what would you tell them? Would you say, yeah, what you wrote is fine, or would you punch it up a little bit?
Well, that's a great question, and I've often thought about the intent of the framers of the Constitution and our other documents, or the Constitution and the Declaration, I should say, and I think that it brings to mind a really important concept, which is intent versus impact. And so there's a lot of gray area, right, in both clauses in terms of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. And I think that in written word, they work. You know, I really do. I think that their intent was pretty on the mark. Its impact is what we have to see, and its impact is guided by the lens of the people who have the power to make these big decisions in our world and throughout history. And so judges, for example, how they see the world is so very important. That's a conversation I'm always having, particularly with my students, which is one of the reasons we need all kinds of diversity in all kinds of places, because people bring their perspectives. So I think that the intent was a good one by our framers. The language is works. And what we've got to constantly look at is the actual impact. And that's why I always say that our laws aren't necessarily religion neutral or race neutral. And we have to be able to see how they actually affect everyone's life.
When we talk about the diversity of minds among the founding fathers, so for instance, we have Thomas Jefferson, who was a deist. We have Patrick Henry, who was a devout Christian. would you say that in the end there might have been a winner, or was it a good compromise in terms of how religion is reflected in our society today in the United States?
Well, I think you have to think about the context of the time, right? The end result of having no state religion, that was a radical idea back then. And that is really, really important to remember. I'm not sure everything always started out that way. I think that there was this idea of, well, if we're going to start a country and I can't have my religion, well, then you're not going to have yours either. There was a little bit of that coming into it. And that is actually one of the ways we ended up with the language we have. Of course, you know, I'm really paraphrasing here and really condensing so many conversations, but the tension is palpable, especially when you fast forward even just a little bit from 1776 to 1802 or so, when the Danbury Baptist congregation wrote a letter expressing their concern that we didn't have essentially a state religion, official religion. And it is Jefferson's response letter back to them where we get the phrase separation of church and state, which I always want to point out because most folks actually think that's somewhere in our founding documents, and it's not. So I think that what was going on with the Danbury Baptist congregation in Connecticut is indicative of the worries that people had about not having Christianity.
And if memory serves,
part of the official country.
Yeah, and if memory serves, isn't it that letter to the Baptists where Jefferson specifically mentions his wanting this to be a country welcoming to, and he enumerates, Muslims, Hindus, and infidels?
Yes, and he, I think, has said that in several places. So, you know, and of course we can look at that language of infidels, you know, and draw some conclusions, but the goal was that this is, we are to include everyone. Now, that's also ironic, in fact, because of what was happening with Native Americans, with the indigenous population, and the way that they were being treated. And then, you know, moving on into 1800s, when in 1819, Congress passes the Civilization Act that essentially provided federal dollars to missionaries to convert Native Americans. Right. So these are the contradictions that arise. Actually, the federal government, perhaps in one of the places where we didn't have a whole lot of red tape and realize why reinvent the wheel that's already been created, saw what the Presbyterians were doing and said, we will fund your efforts. And that's, you know, where we get so much around conversion of Native Americans. And then, of course, we can continue into the way the Native American children were removed from their families, from their villages, from their communities, and put in boarding schools. And their hair was cut. They were given, you know, Anglo clothing to wear, Western Anglo clothing, and taught English.
Yeah, it was referred to as beating the Indian out of them.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is absolutely right. I don't like to actually say it. It really hurts. But it is 100% on the money.
Yeah. You mentioned state churches, and I recall that, for instance, Maryland, I believe, was Catholic, if memory serves.
Correct.
How was that able to exist under the Establishment Clause, and what put an end to that, if you know the answer to that?
The 14th Amendment put an end to it when all states came under the Constitution. But Maryland was a Catholic colony, and it is important, you know, I say white Christian privilege, and I talk about that, but there were at times where we're really specifically talking about Protestant privilege, you know, and that's important to remember because this country has had a long history of anti-Catholicism.
Oh, yes, yes. We talked about that last week with the immigration in the 19th century and early 20th century, that so many of them were Catholic, and that did not go smoothly all the time, to say the least, correct? And you also mentioned, this I did not know, that Jews at one point in our history were arrested for working on Sundays. I did not know that working on Sundays specifically was illegal.
So we've had so many different variations of the Sunday Blue Laws, and many of them now are not, of course, in effect. But in some places, they still are. I happen to live in New Jersey, and we have Bergen County, which is right next door to New York, which on Sundays, retail shops are still closed.
By law?
By law.
Really? Well, we in Western Michigan, I will tell you that now, I believe that this is a credible source. I believe that we have the last McDonald's in the country that ended up opening on a Sunday in our suburb of Jenison.
Yes, it
is now open on Sundays, but for the longest time it wasn't. I'm going to take just a moment here to remind folks that you're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Kati Joshi, and we're talking about her book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. A couple of other questions on school holidays. You spend a great deal of time talking about religion in schools. And last week, of course, it's important to mention that you're not opposed to religious expression in schools as long as it's not organized prayer by faculty and all of this. But apparently there's still a lot of that going on. You bring up the, this is astounding, absolutely astounding. I did not realize that this could go on today. About that Hindu young man, I believe his name was Suhas.
Correct.
Yeah, and he had issues with the soccer team and the National Honor Society around religion. Could you talk about his story and what ultimately happened?
Sure. So he was a young man who was on the soccer team, and they would always gather before the start of the game, and the coach would recite the Lord's Prayer. And he finally kind of was like, no, I'm not doing this. You know, I don't want to do this. And because he would not participate in that huddle for the Lord's Prayer, he got benched, and he was not allowed to start the games. You know, and that we can see, I mean, that is unfortunately a very specific example of Christian privilege coming through, impacting a student's, you know, athletic career, you know, career in high school. And the same student was a member of the National Honor Society, and they had meetings at different churches whenever they met once a month. And he then suggested, you know, to his faculty sponsor that, well, let's meet at the local Hindu temple. And she said, no, we're not going to do that. And he kind of got pretty ticked off, and he stopped going to events. And for any of the listeners out there who are members of any National Honor Society, or your children or somebody are, you know that you have to fulfill certain participation requirements. Well, he, quote unquote, fell out of participation and therefore was kicked off of National Honor Society, graduated at the top of his class, but did not get to wear the NHS stole at graduation. And so these are the kind of things that happened and continue to. We still have coaches having huddles with prayer. at the beginning of games. And this is happening all across the country. And it continues to happen until someone says it's not okay.
So obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, I don't know, but it, apparently Suhas and his family chose not to fight that fight, not to contact the ACLU or make a big stink of it. He just quietly, what, either stopped playing soccer or just got benched and lived with it and lived with the fact that his, he was stripped of his NHS status. Is that right?
Yeah. He did live with it, and actually, his parents didn't even know about the situation with National Honor Society until graduation was upon them. Suhas was part of an immigrant family, and in immigrant families, regardless of national origin or religion, sometimes you you just kind of learn to live with this stuff. You know, you might come home and tell one of your parents that such and such happened at school or such and such teacher wasn't fair. And most immigrant parents are working very hard, long days, trying to provide for families here and elsewhere. And, you know, the children receive messages like, look, don't let it get to you, or, you know, what did you do wrong? and or you must have done something wrong. I know that I got that sometimes.
I was just going to say, this is a credible source we're getting this from.
You know, so you just learned not to necessarily share everything at home. And that's unfortunate. It's something that I think communities are trying to work on, but it's a fact of life.
One of the things that is constantly being negotiated by school systems who really want to do the right thing is the how to handle the issue of school holidays. And you spend a bit of ink on that. Tell me what you suggest to people, to school systems who are trying to make things as equitable as possible.
I think you have to look at who's in your community, who makes up the district, right? And, you know, establish a critical, when you see that there's a critical mass of Hindus or Muslims or those who will, who celebrate the Lunar New Year, for example, and having a holiday then is important. Children and families need to be able to celebrate holidays. These make, you know, family moments. These become part of the family story. Oh, remember back when we did this on Diwali? And when children miss out on that or don't get to celebrate that, you're affecting not only family traditions, but the way students see themselves. Right. And in some cases, there may not be a critical mass. So a lot of times what schools will do is say it's a no homework day. And that certainly helps, you know. But excused absences is also helpful. But remember, there's something very important to keep in mind about excused absences, is that the Hindu student, Muslim, Jewish, whatever religion student might stay home, but the rest of school is going on with its day. And so they're playing catch up. And so I've had folks say to me, I'd rather just go to school, because actually missing school and the makeup is almost double or triple the work. So that's just an important thing to keep in mind for school officials who may be listening in terms of intent versus impact. Certainly good that it's an excused holiday. Certainly great if it's no exam days, you know, no test days, no homework days. That's a step in the right direction. But then we have to think about how students are making that up and then how educators feel. I have a story that I talk about in the book with some of my teachers, some of my pre-service teachers, meaning those who are not out in the world yet teaching, they're doing their internship, being at a school, and some of their mentor teachers making comments about why certain Jewish children were staying home for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and making statements like, well, they're not very Jewish. And that's alarming, because here you have folks judging on how someone should be practicing their faith or not. And then if that's how they're looking at it, are they resentful when they have to stay after school and help those students catch up on the homework? What is their attitude like? So these are things to think about. And again, I always go back to the issue of intent versus impact.
So would you say that, at least for some school districts, the perfect or close to perfect answer would be that on Diwali or on Rosh Hashanah, school is canceled? There just is no school for everybody.
If you have a critical mass of students who make up your community, then that's exactly what should happen.
But you're willing to say that if there's just a handful, if there's, you know, 5 Muslims, 10 Hindus, and 20 Jews in a school, they might have to compromise to say the day off for them.
Yes, and perhaps there are other ways that their faiths can be brought into the school, because the Christian students are getting their days off, and kind of community acknowledgement in other ways. So what else can be done for those students where this part of their life is also included in the school context?
Yes, I understand that. We only have just a few minutes left. This is always the tricky part of the show, Kati, where I want to ask you a good question, but I want to make sure that I don't box you in a corner where you feel the need to expound more than a couple of minutes on it. One term that I learned in the book was scientific racism. Could you explain that to us?
Oh, sure. Scientific racism refers to the pseudoscience of the 1700s and 1800s. This was the idea where European and American academics were involved in trying to show and prove through quote-unquote experiments that white folks are superior. And at the bottom of the ladder, at the bottom of the rung, are black folks, and they are truly inferior. And then everybody else was kind of in between. And it really fell along skin color. And they would do experiments and wanted, you know, if we can kind of show that the size of one's nose shows patterns, or cranial head size shows shows X to be able to make the determination that black folks are inferior, then this would further help the cause. And what's really important to know about this is that while it now can seem like mumbo jumbo, at the time it was taken very seriously. It is those academics in the United States that were actually called upon to give congressional testimony that helped lead to the Immigration Act of 1924, which combined with other legislation just completely shut doors to Asian immigration. That really happened in 1917 for Asians. But in 1924, we limited people coming from Southern and Eastern Europe. And these academics who were propagating these theories of scientific racism provided the heft, if you will, to do that. Scientific racism is also the precursor to Nazi ideology. And that's a very, very important link to make, so that, you know, American academics help create Nazi ideology.
And this would be, I'm guessing, a sibling to eugenics?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. All of these ideas and, unfortunately, movements are related.
I'm going to ask you to, I've got one more question. I'm going to ask you to answer it in a sentence, if you could, but it's, I'm curious. These people who conquered all of these other peoples and brought religion to them, I'm assuming that even if they felt they were inferior, they must have believed that they had souls. Am I correct?
Soul, I mean, souls that needed saving.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yes. I mean, you know, they might acknowledge, but, you know, right away, again, you know, I'm thinking of Native American populations, right, who were identified as heathen, right?
Yes.
And that's, I think, in a really important thing that is, we do have to remember that when folks are saying someone needs to be saved, they're perhaps coming even today from a point of goodness, right? Because this is what they believe in their heart of hearts.
Yes, exactly.
And what I need evangelical Christians and others who believe that way to understand is that your intent may be, you know, good in your world and in, from your eyes, but the impact on me personally is, you know, how dare you say that my religion is inferior? Because that's how I hear it.
And we will leave it at that as we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much, Kati, for your time today and your time last week as well. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Kati Joshi, talking about her book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. Please join us again next week.